I hated to give up the middle-class tax cut, but with the deficit numbers worse, there was no choice. If our strategy worked, the middle class would see direct benefits worth far more than a tax cut, in the form of lower home mortgages and lower interest rates on things like car payments, credit card purchases, and student loans. We also wouldn't be able to increase spending as much as I had proposed in the campaign, at least at first. But if deficit reduction brought interest rates down and growth up, tax revenues would increase, and I could still meet my investment objectives over 4 years. That was a big if. There were compelling arguments for it, but the most important domestic decision of my presidency was still one big gamble. At the beginning of my last week in Arkansas, with moving vans in the driveway, I gave a farewell interview to Arkansas reporters, confessing the mixed emotions of pride and regret at leaving home. I've been happy and proud and sad, almost on the point of tears a couple of times. I love my life here. One of my final tasks before leaving for Washington was personal. Chelsea had a pet frog she had initially gotten for a school science project. While we were taking our cat's socks with us, Chelsea decided she wanted to free the frog so that it could lead a normal life. She asked me to do it, so on my last day in Arkansas, I jogged down to the Arkansas River, took the shoebox the frog was in, climbed down a steep bank to the water, and let the frog go. At least one of us was returning to normal life. The transition period was hectic and hard. In retrospect, we did a good job picking a cabinet and sub-cabinet officials who were able and who reflected the diversity of America. But I made a mistake in not appointing a prominent Republican to a cabinet post as a demonstration of my desire to build bipartisan cooperation. I also kept my commitment to put the economy first, with a first-rate team, the economic summit, and a decision-making process that was well-informed and subject to thorough debate. And as I had pledged, Al Gore was a full partner in the incoming administration, involved in all the strategy meetings and the cabinet and White House staff selections, and maintaining a high public profile. After several days of public events to celebrate our inaugural, entitled An American Reunion, New Beginnings, Renewed Hope, on January the 20th at 11:30 a.m., I walked out onto the platform on the west front of the Capitol with Hail to the Chief playing. I gazed out onto the vast crowd, which filled the large grounds of the Capitol and spilled back over onto the Mall and up Constitution and Pennsylvania Avenue. The throng was big and full of all kinds of people, old and young, of all races and faiths, from all walks of life. I was happy that so many people who'd made this day possible were there to share it. After being sworn in, I delivered my address to those on the Mall and across the world watching on television. I said that today a generation raised in the shadows of the Cold War assumes new responsibilities in a world warmed by the sunshine of freedom, but threatened still by ancient hatreds and new plagues. Raised in unrivaled prosperity, we inherit an economy that is still the world's strongest, but is weakened. Profound and powerful forces are shaking and remaking our world, and the urgent question of our time is whether we can make change our friend and not our enemy. There is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America. Early on, I was hit with the first big controversy of my administration, arising out of my pledge to allow gays to serve in the military. On the night of January 25th, at their urgent request, I met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss the issue. The day before, the New York Times had reported that because of strong military opposition to the change, I would delay issuing formal regulations lifting the ban for 6 months, while the views of senior officers as well as practical problems were considered. The Joint Chiefs' early request for a meeting created a problem. I was more than willing to hear them out, but I didn't want the issue to get any more publicity than it already was, not because I was trying to hide my position, but because I didn't want the public to think I was paying more attention to it than to the economy. That's exactly what the congressional Republicans wanted the American people to think. Senator Bob Dole was already talking about passing a resolution removing my authority to lift the ban. He clearly wanted this to be the defining issue of my first weeks in office. In the meeting, the chiefs acknowledged that there were thousands of gay men and women serving with distinction in the 1.8 million member military, but maintained that letting them serve openly would be, in General Colin Powell's words, prejudicial to good order and discipline. The rest of the Joint Chiefs were with the chairman. When I raised the fact that it apparently had cost the military $500 million to kick 17,000 homosexuals out of the service in the previous decade, despite a government report saying there was no reason to believe they could not serve effectively, the chiefs replied that it was worth it to preserve unit cohesion and morale. Almost exactly 6 months later, on July 19th, after votes in both houses of Congress overwhelmingly opposing my position, I went to the National Defense University at Fort McNair to announce, "Don't ask, don't tell." On paper, the military had moved a long way, to live and let live, while holding on to the idea that it couldn't acknowledge gays without approving of homosexuality and compromising morale and cohesion. In practice, it often didn't work out that way. Many anti-gay officers simply ignored the new policy and worked even harder to root out homosexuals, costing the military millions of dollars that would have been far better spent making America more secure. In the short run, I got the worst of both worlds. I lost the fight, and the gay community was highly critical of me for the compromise, simply refusing to acknowledge the consequences of having so little support in Congress, and giving me little credit for lifting another ban on gays against serving in critical national security positions, and for the substantial number of gays and lesbians who were working throughout the administration. By contrast, Senator Dole won big. By raising the issue early and repeatedly, he guaranteed it so much publicity that it appeared that I was working on little else, which caused a lot of Americans who had elected me to fix the economy to wonder what on earth I was doing and whether they'd made a mistake. February ended in violence. On the 26th, a truck bomb exploded at Manhattan's World Trade Center, killing 6 people and injuring more than 1,000. The investigation quickly revealed it to be the work of terrorists from the Middle East who hadn't covered their tracks very well. The first arrests were made on March 4th. Eventually, 6 of the conspirators were convicted in federal court in New York and sentenced to 240 years in prison. I was pleased with the effectiveness of our law enforcement work, but troubled by the evident vulnerability of our open society to terror. My national security team began to devote more attention to terror networks and what we could do to protect ourselves and free societies around the world against them. On February 28th, 4 agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms were killed and 16 others wounded at the onset of a confrontation with a religious cult, the Branch Davidians, at their compound outside Waco, Texas. A prolonged standoff ensued. On Sunday night, April 18th, Attorney General Janet Reno came to the White House to tell me that the FBI wanted to storm the compound, apprehend the sect's messianic leader, David Koresh, and any of his followers who had taken part in killing the agents or some other crime, and free the rest of the people. She said that the FBI was tired of waiting, that the standoff was costing the government $1 million a week and tying up law enforcement resources needed elsewhere, and that the possibilities of child sexual abuse and mass suicide were real, because Koresh was crazy and so were many of his followers. Finally, I told her that if she thought it was the right thing to do, she could go ahead. The next day, the raid went terribly wrong. After the FBI fired the tear gas into the buildings where the people were holed up, the Davidians started to fire. When it ended, more than 80 people had died, including 25 children. Only 8 survived. My biggest early foreign policy challenge was in Bosnia. In 1989, as the Soviet Union crumbled and communism's demise in Europe accelerated, the question of what political philosophy would replace it was being answered in different ways in different countries. In Yugoslavia, as the nation struggled to reconcile the competing claims of its ethnic and religious constituencies, Serbian nationalism prevailed over democracy under the leadership of the country's dominant political figure, Slobodan Milosevic. By 1991, Yugoslavia's westernmost provinces, Slovenia and Croatia, both predominantly Catholic, had declared independence from Yugoslavia. Fighting then broke out between Serbia and Croatia and spilled over into Bosnia, the most ethnically diverse province of Yugoslavia, where Muslims constituted about 45% of the population, Serbs were just over 30%, and Croatians about 17%. The so-called ethnic differences in Bosnia were really political and religious. Over the previous millennium, Bosnia had been the meeting place of 3 imperial expansions: the Catholic Holy Roman Empire from the west, the Orthodox Christian movement from the east, and the Muslim Ottoman Empire from the south. In 1991, the Bosnians were governed by a coalition of national unity, headed by the leading Muslim politician, Alija Izetbegovic, and including the militant Serbian nationalist leader Radovan Karadzic, a Sarajevo psychiatrist. At first, Izetbegovic wanted Bosnia to be an autonomous, multi-ethnic, multi-religious province of Yugoslavia. When Slovenia and Croatia were recognized by the international community as independent nations, Izetbegovic decided that the only way Bosnia could escape Serbian dominance was to seek independence too. Karadzic and his allies, who were tied closely to Milosevic, had a very different agenda. They were supportive of Milosevic's desire to turn as much of Yugoslavia as he could hold on to into a greater Serbia, including Bosnia.